Well, good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and what an honor to have as our guest Dr. Ron Paul. What do you say about Ron Paul? I could easily do the whole show and not even cover his achievements, his qualifications, the millions that he's inspired. Let me just say he's Mr. Liberty. I mean, he's Dr. Liberty, the leader of the libertarian movement, a man who, in his political campaigns and his work in Congress, his books, his writings, his speeches, has inspired so many people all over the world, not just in America, to be interested in Austrian economics, to be interested in the cause of freedom, to be interested in sound money, sound banking, and the cause of peace. So, Ron, it's an honor to have you. And, you know, something else I could talk a long time about you is all the things that you've predicted that turned out to be right. Maybe we wish they hadn't turned out to be right, but they have. And one of them, I can remember in the 1980s, you were warning about the cashless society, that the government and the whole financial regime would like to have gotten rid of paper money. It's funny to be defending paper money, but anyway, in this context, we do. So you predicted this in the 80s, and now it's all coming true. We in Europe and this country, banks, countries, central banks, economists, all calling for the abolition of cash, the outlawing of cash, in fact. So tell us, as again, you've been talking about this for a long time. What does this mean? What's happening?
You know, it's amazing because we're always looking for positive things and think about states raising the ire against the federal government and starting to nullify drug laws and different things. And there's a few states now moving in the direction. Well, they're told in the Constitution that they can only use gold and silver as legal tender. And yet here we go with Louisiana. What's going on there where they go out of their way to pass a law to deny people from using cash, in yard sales? And, you know, it's absolutely bizarre. But, no, I think the movement is, evident to everybody right now because banks are on their side. The banks, I think, the biggest thing on the banks is just an old pragmatic concern. They're not into it much more. They see if there's a need for people to take their money out of the bank, that this could, you know, call on their reserves. Because right now, it's probably just as well to have Federal Reserve notes in a shoebox in a bank. You know, if the bank on a crisis will close it down, you can't get it. But if you keep it in there or put it in a treasury bill or a money market fund, and if you get a negative interest rate, you put it in the bank, not only does the inflation rate eat it up, but they may only give you $95 back or $97 back for $100. So people have this incentive to get out of the system. But of course, governments love it. I think the first debate I ever had was back in the 80s with an authoritarian. I thought, well, he thought it was a pretty neat idea because there's always trouble collecting sales taxes. And he saw this as a real tax enhancer. So I think that is true, too. It serves the benefit of big government. And we all know, especially those who have been exposed to Austrian economics, is that even if you do have a sound monetary system, even a gold standard, you don't want a gold reserve standard or a bullion standard. You always want to have a gold coin standard where the person gets to vote on the soundness of the banks and the government by always turning in that paper money and seeing if they can get the gold coin. So in this sense, though, we're going in the wrong direction, but the system that we have today and this attack on cash will not do much good for the economy. It will drive people maybe more into black markets. I'm sure there were plenty of black markets, which is, you know, really the real market. You know, even in a Soviet system, people survive that way. So if they really, really crack down on cash, there'll be something else. They'll have alternatives. The big thing, though, is if it becomes illegal, that if you even are seen using cash and it becomes a crime, it's going to be hard to even use that in a black market. But I do think that the market then, there'd be some nullification. I think the people who want to survive are like the people who wanted to get out of Vietnam. You didn't get out of Vietnam with paper piastres. You got out of Vietnam with gold. So maybe this is a sign that the paper standard is coming to an end, and maybe that's a good sign, and maybe we'll see some serious thought about sound money once again.
Well, Ron, it's interesting. There are some European economists following up to your exact point who feel that if the governments of Europe and the EU actually succeed in outlawing cash, and this obviously would apply in this country as well, that gold would become hand-to-hand money again, that this would be something people would actually use. Know what the government's reaction to that would be, I guess we can guess, but it's an interesting point.
Yeah, and usually, you know, when paper money self-destructs, in the past, so far in our history, they have always resorted to saying, well, the only way you can get confidence back is showing that the currency is related to a precious metal. But if the authoritarians don't yield and say, yeah, I guess you guys are right, we're going to put a little gold behind this and sort of mellow it over a bit, then the gold is always there. It will cause people to need to break the law because that might be the way they survive and how they buy food. So it'll be a de facto gold standard. It remains to be seen on how ruthless they're going to be. We do know that economic crimes in a dictatorship like the Soviets were, an economic crime was essentially everything that they had. You know, no matter what you did wrong, whether it was political or not, the economic punishment was that, well, you lost your job and you lost your rent, you lost your house and everything else. So economic crimes become the most vicious of crimes. So that means that people then, if they want to survive, they're going to have to use an alternative. Of course, I hope and pray that we never get that far gone.
You know, Ron, something else that you've always been right about was trade. You're a great advocate of free trade, real free trade, and you've also been an opponent of phony free trade, these big trade agreements that are sort of a crony capitalist corporate estate thing, and to the benefit of the government and the big companies associated with it and the hurt of everybody else. So now we've just had, I think just today, the Senate passed fast track authority for the president. And you've always pointed out this sort of fast track business is unconstitutional and bad in many other ways too. What's happening with the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is another example that I use when people think that there's a real fight between Republicans and Democrats. You know, that's all pretense, because whether it's a support for a war and things like that, you know, they come together. And internationalism and big government is endorsed by both parties. So therefore, you know, you had Boehner and the Obama and everybody else coming together. Progressive Democrats were left standing. And of course, libertarians and populists on the other side, they were left stranded. But the authoritarians really pushed it through. But, you know, when I explain this to people, I try to avoid it, making it too complicated, that we can deal with this just with the idea of a basic human right and the right to the fruits of your labor, and that you ought to be able to spend it. So if that is the case, why can't I buy an automobile any place I want if I live in a free country? But all of a sudden becomes, you know, well, we got to take care of our industries. We don't want our companies to go bankrupt. We might have to bail them out. We have to take care of union wages. But they forget that one premise that I know Mises used to talk about a long time ago, was that the free market is not designed for these people. It's not designed to have high wages or profits for companies. It's designed to satisfy the consumer. And once you get into managed trade, and that's what these fast track things are, they're managed trade. I am quite sure that they probably get more permission to put on sanctions as punishments than they do to lower tariffs. The big argument, and some libertarians fall into the trap, well, the main purpose, we know what you're saying is sort of right, but the goal is to lower tariffs. And of course, we should be for lower tariffs, but I think it protects big companies, not the small guy who would like to just go out and spend his money anyway once.
And Ron, of course, these non-tariff barriers are huge and growing too. It's not just tariffs. There are quotas and all kinds of dumping, anti-dumping regulations and so forth, all other ways to bring about protectionism that don't necessarily involve tariffs.
Well, you know, and what did I and many, many others who are in our camp get blamed for, that we're not for free trade? But they're the ones who put on sanctions. they call us isolationists. Therefore, we're isolationists. They're not for free trade, which is completely wrong. Because these same people who would always say, I am an isolationist and therefore a bad person, I don't want to deal with the rest of the world, they're the ones who are putting these vicious sanctions on companies and blockading companies, which, as far as I'm concerned, are acts of war. And then they are able to get away with charging us with isolationism and not willing to be able to work within a worldwide community. But it's only free trade and freedom that allows real communications with other countries and all people.
Right. I can remember back during the debate over NAFTA, making the point that free trade is I can drive my car to Mexico, I can fill it up with packages, I drive back, I just wave at the guy at the border. They don't get to see what I've got. They don't get to charge me fees or that's free trade.
Yeah. You know, and there was it was never perfect, but I've lived on both borders when I was in a residency in Detroit. Going back and forth was rather easy. I mean, it was always easier, a little bit easier in Canada. Now you need a passport. But in Mexico, when I was in the military in San Antonio, we frequently went to the border, and we didn't think of a big deal, you know, to drive over and bring over packages. It seems like we'd flash them our driver's license or something, but they generally were glad to see us because we were going to spend some money. But it's changed so much, you know, and there's a lot of factors on that, bad economies and protectionism and drug wars. So those are consequences of all bad policy. But, you know, I keep thinking that actually, if we'd have kept our states separate, we started off with 13, but they had a fairly good idea. They said free travel. And that you can, and we'll have a single currency in it, and it worked pretty well. We would be horrified to think that, you know, if we had to keep track of trade balances between California and New York to decide what trade policy ought to be. And it's great that we can travel back and forth, but as soon as you try to translate that into something else, oh, you couldn't do that. That would be impossible. They would come in. But once again, a bad economy is a welfare state that people come in and they become political tools. And it's the system. You know, I am absolutely convinced that if we had the free market that we've been working for, we would have an open door policy because we would need workers, you know. And there was a time when we did, even though as imperfect as it was, when we had these workers programs, people came, they didn't bring their family. They worked 3 months and took their money home and bought American products with the money that they had. The money always had to come back here. But there was not so much fear and intimidation. I've said this in the debates, and I never got a lot of grief over it, but I know they weren't going to accept this policy. I think sometimes these interruptions on trade, we use the illegal immigrants as the scapegoat for everything rather than the welfare state that teaches our people not to work, as well as encourages foreigners to bring families illegally and they end up getting free education, free medical care. That is not the free society that we're talking about.
You know, I saw a chart that David Stockman had today talking about the male participation in the workforce had dropped over the last 65 years from about 87% to about 67%. And of course, it's because of the welfare state, because it's diminishes the incentives and sometimes blocks people from being able to work.
Yeah, I think there's 93 million Americans now out of the workforce. And guess what? The employment rate, unemployment rate's pretty low. Oh, that's good. Down to 5.5%. I guess that policy's working. Yeah, but we don't count 93 million Americans. So they're fudging these figures all right now. And they're really involved with trying to doctor up the economic statistics, too. And how can they're working hard, even though we've known for years that they doctor up the GDP prices. They sort of admitted that they're doing this. We need to make it look better. Then we can raise interest rates a little bit because they're concerned. Interest rates are zero. That's not good because if the recession comes, there's nothing we can do. if we had interest rates up to 5, then we could deal with the recession. But what happens when you have an absolute horrendous recession and zero interest rates? It sort of puts them out of the ball game, and they're important people. They have to manage this economy. They're economic planners. What would happen with it? They become unemployed if we don't have an economy. They can run into the ground anymore. You know, once they get it in this bad a shape, they don't know what to do about it.
Ron, another worrisome thing is, of course, always war. I must say I've always been slightly suspicious that ISIS always seemed to me like a vaudeville troupe. I mean, it seemed like maybe it was helped put together by American intelligence and French and British and Israeli and who else knows. But it certainly has served the purpose, even if they didn't design it that way, of stimulating Americans' interest and belief in war. There was a period earlier when people were saying we've had enough. Now they're afraid that ISIS is going to come and behead everybody in Pittsburgh, and therefore there has to be U.S. troops over there.
They have to build up the fear, because people got disgusted after Vietnam for a few years, and now they're disgusted with Bush. Bush is still not very popular because he had unpopular wars. But as long as our killing is sterile, that we can do it from drones, they won't hate us quite as much, and the Americans won't die. But right now, the big move is to really build up the hatred, because they're getting ready to move more troops in. But, you know, we did our little internet program today with Daniel McAdams, and I made one point that just blows my mind, even though we've known this principle exists for a long time. Is, you know, when Ramadi fell, they gained a lot of American weapons because, you know, our trained allies had to run, and they left all their weapons, so they had ended up with a bunch of American tanks. So today it was announced that America is sending 1,000 anti-tank missiles to go and blow up all those American tanks that ISIS has, and I guess the main beneficiaries are the military industrial complex, and people just, you know, okay, I guess that's nothing we can do about it. But a lot of people don't know about it, and you know, they just ignore it. But that type of a policy can't last. And I think now that we have this pivot to the Far East and that chaos in the Middle East, that and our budget and our finances aren't so good, this will come to an end. It's just a matter of time. And this is how all empires come down. It's for financial reasons. Soviet system is a good example. We didn't have to have that nuclear war with the Soviets. They took care of themselves, and they never had much freedom for the individual anyway. So now we've destroyed the individual freedom in this country, and the financial situation is in such shambles. We can expect something soon, you know, and of course, nobody should ever push an Austrian economist onto the day that's going to happen, because that, of course, we don't know, but this trend cannot continue.
Ron, just before we go, I want to mention how great the Ron Paul Liberty Report is. This is your daily show. It's on YouTube. It's free. There's no paywall. You do it with Daniel McAdams, your longtime foreign policy aide in Congress and now head of the Ron Paul Institute. And it's a tremendous show, and it's on. We always put it on the LRC. Daniel's nice enough to put it on the LRC blog every day. And we'll have, of course, a link to your YouTube channel, so that people can look at it. I encourage, if you're not seeing the Ron Paul Liberty Report, you're not understanding what's going on in foreign policy and many other issues. It's short, it's smart, it catches your attention. You'll learn a lot. You'll know more than any of the media who's talking about foreign policy and other issues.
Well,
so take a look at it.
Thank you for that. And our management of that show has changed recently. We have total control of it here in Lake Jackson, Texas. And I'll tell you, somebody told me that they noticed I'm having a lot more fun.
Well, I think, Ron, we have to take Lake Jackson over Hollywood any day.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you for coming on the show.
All right, Lou.
Bye-bye. Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.